You know, my husband will say to me if I'm having a really bad day and, you know, the world kind of sucks, he'll say, go paint, you'll feel better. And it's true. It just, you know, it lets me put all the junk in my head aside and focus on this thing that I love.
Welcome to the Flying Fruit Bowl, platform dedicated to the discussion and exploration of art and the creative process. I'm the host and creator, Aaron S., and for this week's episode, I had a conversation with the amazing Valerie Larko. Valerie is a fine artist from New Rochelle, New York, who uses art as a medium to explore her surroundings. Favouring locations based upon the urban fringe, Valerie creates her paintings plein air, often spending weeks and months in one location to study how it changes over time. Okay, then. So I'm going to start where I start with everybody. Would you just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you became an artist?
All right. Well, to tell you a little bit about myself, I grew up in northern New Jersey in the United States. And as I kind of already alluded to, I did grow up in a very dysfunctional family, which sometimes can actually be a help to artists, believe it or not. So, unfortunately, my mother was severely mentally ill and was in and out of mental hospitals my whole childhood. My father suffered from depression and alcoholism, probably from living with my mother, who was not easy. And that's putting it mildly. She really had a lot of issues. And then, unfortunately, my older brother, who is 7 years older than me, he too suffered from mental illness, severe mental illness, and was self-medicating also with drugs and alcohol. Luckily, I won the genetic lotto, and for just dumb luck, I will forever be grateful that I did not succumb to the family illness, let's call it, any of them. So what happened, though, when I was a kid, I did like to draw and paint like most kids do. And I had a wonderful aunt, my aunt Antoinette, and she would come over and she knew how to draw because she was an interior designer. And she would always be willing to draw something for me. And that was kind of sweet, too. So between me liking this and this wonderful aunt, I just always enjoyed painting and drawing. Then all of a sudden, I get out of high school and I'm like, what am I going to do? I had been encouraged to go to college by my parents, but not in a supportive way. Yeah, you're going to go to college. But what did that mean? There was not a lot of guidance. So the only college I'd ever, the only place I'd been to really outside of the New Jersey, New York metropolitan area was Florida. And there was a community college in the place where we had vacationed a few times. So I just, it was like throwing a dart at a map. I went to a community college there. And while I did not stay in Florida, it did not really work out for me. I only stayed one semester. I missed New Jersey and my friends. I mean, I was only 18. What did I know? But I knew from those classes I took at community college, the art classes, that I think I want to do this. So I came back to New Jersey and I took some classes at community college in New Jersey. And at 19, I took an oil painting class. And it was like all the stars aligned. Everything just kind of gelled. And then I knew that this was the medium I really enjoyed and that I needed to go to art school if I was going to really get any good at this. So I guess that's how I started my journey as an artist.
Wow. It's quite interesting to hear that actually your childhood was quite difficult and like the family home wasn't the most like safest of environments, but it's kind of interesting how art actually gave you that form of escape, that it kind of allows you to be able to kind of process all your emotions and your thoughts and your feelings, as well as also just become something from that.
This is true. I really feel like art saved me. I don't know how else to put it, but I've always thought, well, when I was a kid, I thought one thing, that I wasn't going to let my family's messed up, dysfunctional, you know, world be an excuse for me to not succeed in life. I didn't know what that was going to mean at that time, but I knew I didn't want to be like them. And then the other thing is that it is an escape. You're absolutely right. And when I got older and really realized this is what I was going to do for the rest of my life, I would say to myself, nobody gave me art. Nobody can take it away. This is totally mine. And I enjoy it so much. I've been very, very fortunate.
Wow. So at what point did you feel comfortable calling yourself an artist?
Well, probably within, I don't know, probably pretty early, actually. Once I was in art school, I knew it was going to be what I would do for the rest of my life. So by then I was an artist. Maybe not a very good artist, but I was definitely an artist.
Yeah, because I think that's one thing that I see with a lot of artists that I talk to, especially, that they never know like how to refer to themselves, because, you know, sometimes they might not be making a lot of money off it, or they might be, you know, kind of in that phase where they're just experimenting with what they want to do and they're not too sure if they can really fully call themselves that. Do you think there is like a threshold as to like when somebody can call themselves an artist?
No. No. I think whenever you feel this is going to be your life's work, you're an artist. It's that simple.
That's amazing. And that's actually really, really true, though, because I feel like, end of the day, if you don't give yourself that title and that kind of outlook, then you won't reach the potential you can reach, because you don't have that mindset to then go forward and create the work you want to create, knowing that this is what you're inclined to do, right? This is your path in life, for instance.
So, and of course, once you decide on this path of being an artist, you have committed to something that will not be easy. So perhaps having a difficult childhood, as I did, helped me be in a way kind of fearless. Hey, I survived that. I can survive anything. I can be an artist. I'll figure this out. That's it. I'm just going to make it work.
So actually, that's really true. That's actually really true in terms of this idea of like what you have. And if you don't have a lot, then you have nothing to really to lose, because you're used to not having a lot. However, if you're raised in a household where you have a lot, you have everything in abundance, that fear of not having it will then kind of mold or like shape the way you view your life and things you do and the decisions you make. That's actually a really interesting point from a psychological point of view, just as in general with people. That's quite interesting, actually. That's a really good way of looking at it, actually. So what was the biggest challenge of being an artist, would you say?
The biggest challenge, and it will be for most artists for most of their career, is finances. Unless you're born rich or you got a trust fund or, you know, some great whirlwind luck comes your way and you win the financial lotto, you win a couple of million dollars. Supporting oneself as an artist is not easy. I should know. I did not have family money to fall back on. I mean, that just wasn't really a thing. I mean, they helped me a little bit with art school and stuff, but there was no, you know, I wasn't going to inherit a ton of money. I didn't come from a bunch of money. So I had to figure out how to find time, and time really is the most valuable thing for an artist, find time to make art and still find a way to support myself. So juggling has been the thing I've done most of my life. Early on, after I got out of art school, while I was in art school, I waitressed. After I got out of art school, I did a little bit more waitressing, but then I went into doing some graphic design work. And it's like the waitressing I did at night so that I could paint during the day. So I had to figure out a lot of different things. I moved out of my family home when I was 18, and I just figured out how to make it work, whether I rented the cheapest room I could find for $110 a month. Can you imagine? I'm not that young. And stuff like that. I just always figured out how to juggle. And I also had to figure out how to sell my work relatively early in my career, because every time I sold a painting, it let me buy time to make more paintings. So this is, I really, for me anyway, and for most of the artists I know, finances, being able to support oneself and have enough time to create, to experiment, to get better at your craft. There's nothing like time. Time is what you need to be a good artist.
So how has that kind of developed over the course of your career? Like, do you find yourself having more or less time now that you're a full-time artist?
Well, I'm not exactly a full-time artist. I am still teaching, very part-time though. So let me think about this. Well, I do have more time to paint. That's absolutely true. But there's never enough time to paint. I think a lot of artists probably feel that way because painting is my happy place.
Yeah.
It's, you know, my husband will say to me if I'm having a really bad day and, you know, the world kind of sucks, he'll say, go paint, you'll feel better. And it's true. It just, you know, it lets me put all the junk in my head aside and focus on this thing that I love. You know, even though I've been painting in oils since I was 19, which was many years ago, it's always been my happy place. It's a place, like we said earlier in this conversation, where I can escape the world, my troubles, whatever's going on. If I can't block everything out and paint, then I know I'm really in a bad place.
So what kind of skills or like different hats do you need to wear as an artist?
Oh, yes. What kind of skills? Woohoo. Well, so very many. One of the things artists often don't realize is it's a rare artist who gets discovered out of nowhere. You have to not only be able to make the work, you have to make sure people see it. And then you have to make sure you sell some of it so you can buy more art supplies and more time in the studio, or in my case, more time outdoors to paint. You know, you have to find all of these different things in order to be have a successful career. It's like you're running a small business and you are the sole proprietor and you are doing everything. You're making the product, painting or sculpture or whatever. You're making the product. You have to exhibit the product so you just don't have it in your studio and nobody ever sees it. You have to figure out how to cultivate curators so you can get in good exhibitions, how to let people know what you do. Getting press is important because that brings more people your way. How do you get press? That's a whole nother skill set. How do you balance and juggle a budget? Figure out enough money for your supplies, your studio, having your work professionally photographed, having a website. I mean, and then you have to figure out what skills should I spend my time on, what tasks, and what would be better if I hired somebody. Like, I don't photograph my own artwork. I am not a good photographer, and I don't want to be, and I don't want to buy lights and paper and all that other stuff. So I hire somebody who does an excellent job. And the same thing, I don't update my own website. I send all the update I want to a guy who's wonderful. He's my web guy. And I'd rather pay him than struggle with how do I plug this in? How do I do this? You know, so you have to figure out what you're good at, what you're not good at, what's worth your time, and what's not worth your time. So there is a very large skill set that goes into being a professional artist. Now, if you're just painting for your own sake and you don't care whether you sell anything, you know, you're just doing it for yourself on the side, that's a different thing. But for a professional artist, if you want to get anywhere with this, it's a very large skill set that you have to develop over time. It doesn't happen overnight.
What's been the one most beneficial skill you've taught yourself or you've learned?
Well, I think it's a skill I learned relatively recently. How to use Instagram. Let's face it, that's how you found me. And that's how a lot of people have found me. Back right before the pandemic, I took a class on how to, you know, be better at Instagram. I, you know, I was okay, but I didn't really know much. And there's a wonderful woman, I'm going to give a shout out to an artist friend of mine, Dina Brodsky. She's on Instagram. And she's a miniature artist, but she also teaches these workshops. I did one in person. Now she does them mostly on Zoom since the pandemic. And she taught me a lot. And this has helped me get my art in front of more people than I ever could in any other venue. I've had solo museum shows that didn't even get me as many eyeballs on my paintings as Instagram. So for me, it's been empowering. And I really do think, even though the algorithm kind of sucks right now, you know, they're always tweaking it. They want us to spend a lot of money. I never buy any ads on Instagram. It's actually detrimental to the organic reach of your art. So it's better never to pay. Learned that from Dina. Thanks, Dina. And so I have found so many good things. I've sold artwork. I got a solo museum show because of Instagram. A curator posted one of my paintings she had seen in an art gallery in New York City. I just thanked her. Always thank people. I just thanked her. She then wrote back, said, here's my email. Email me. She put me in a group sketchbook show. Then she gave me a solo show a couple of years later. Wow. That wouldn't have happened without Instagram. At least I don't think it would have. And then, like I said, I've reached collectors. I've reached art critics. I've reached you. And another thing that will happen sometime later this year is a film guy, director, contacted me. He's in the process of making a documentary about my art. He found me on Instagram.
That's amazing.
That is a wonderful thing to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. I think it's very easy to forget nowadays, especially, that social media is really powerful. And the fact that you having your work online somewhere, anywhere, is helpful to your career. Because I think a lot of people just kind of think that, oh, the algorithm isn't working, no one's seeing my work. And actually, anybody, you don't know who is actually seeing your work. And that next person could be anybody. Anybody important could give you something else, could give you the opportunities that you really want. It's about, I think, persevering. I feel like that's such a really good thing to hear. It's actually quite a positive thing to hear. I think that we all do need to actually hear at this point in time.
And I didn't, social media, what's that? When I was a kid, we didn't even have computers.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were no cell phones. Selfies? What's that? I mean, the world has completely changed. And in spite of its downside, I think the internet is the miracle of my lifetime. You know, it just has opened up so many more things and given artists so much more control over their career if they choose to take the time. Now, I'm not going to tell you it doesn't take time. It's like having a part-time job. But for me, the rewards have been worth the time in learning how to make better posts and trying to post fairly often. Although not every day. I have a life.
True. That's very true. So actually, let's talk about your work. So can you describe your work for those who may not have seen it?
Sure. I paint urban and industrial landscapes on location. I started painting in this way. I paint in oils. I started painting in this way when I got out of art school, and all of a sudden I was living in Jersey City. I went to art school thinking I was going to be a portrait or figure painter. I like painting people in art school. But all of a sudden you get out of art school, nobody wants to pose. How many self-portraits can you paint? How many times could I ask my boyfriend to pose for me? All of a sudden I'm like, okay, you know, I can't drive myself crazy. So I started going out in the area around Jersey City. The very first place I went, I lived there for 3.5 years, right after art school, was this park. And it overlooked the industrial sublime that is part of Jersey City. And I just set up my easel. I used to walk my dog there. So I just set up my easel and started painting there. Because the one thing that has been consistent throughout my painting journey is that I prefer working from life rather than photos. Now, if I need a photo, I'll use it. I have nothing against photos. People do great work from photos. But I personally like to work from life. That's why after I got done with Ducre School of the Arts, I went to the Art Students League and the National Academy of Design so I could have models pose for me and I could, you know, improve my skills. But like I said, once you get out of art school, nobody wants to pose for you. So, and I didn't have any money. It wasn't like I could afford to hire models. So I just started going around in the area where I lived and saying, okay, this is my life now. Let me see what I can make out of this. And the rest is history.
So, because obviously your work is very industrial, but why is like the fringe of society or kind of like this industrial part of society, why does that intrigue you? As opposed to say like the beautiful, gleaming, like new neighborhoods, for instance.
Well, I think living in Jersey City when I finished art school, I lived in a very, Jersey City is one of the most populated cities in all of Jersey. So it was just, it's where I landed. And I'd always enjoyed painting landscapes when I was in art school, like in the summer when there were no classes. I would go out and paint in some beautiful area with my friends. And I wasn't going to do that once I moved to Jersey City, drive an hour to find some pretty scene. I just said, well, I'm going to paint what's around me. And then after I started painting more like overviews, panoramas of the area surrounding Jersey City from, you know, different parks and vantage points like that, I started going into these parks, these industrial parks, and painting close-ups of these tanks, these chemical tanks, these hoppers, all these interesting forms. For me, it was almost like painting, you know, sculpture. It was just fun. I really enjoyed those early paintings I did. So I painted in industrial parks for a number of years, but then things started to change after that. You see, when I go out to paint, the truth is I never know what I'm going to paint until I find it. I do a lot of time just exploring areas until something speaks to me and I think it's worth spending my time on. One of my big paintings can take me 2 to 3 months to do on site. There's a little bit of adjustment I do in the studio because there's so much illumination outside that you want to make sure the painting looks as good indoors as it does outdoors.
Yeah,
so that's another thing I learned over time, that somewhere about a third to midway point of a painting, I have to bring that outside and make sure the values aren't too dark and that the painting will look as good indoors, because that's where it's going to be exhibited, as it does outdoors where I painted it.
Yeah, that's not something I actually ever thought about in terms of like how the space in which the painting is placed will affect the actual values of the painting itself.
Oh, absolutely. And like I said, I learned that the hard way. My earlier paintings were kind of dark, some of them.
I mean, that could be a whole aesthetic by itself.
Yeah. And anyway, go ahead. Next.
I was going to say, so it could take like 2 to 3 months. So what is like that process like in terms of like, So do you take your paints with you knowing you're going to wander around and create a piece of work? Or do you stumble across somewhere and be like, okay, I'm going to come back to this place again and then take your paints? Like, what is like the creative process like?
Okay, this is my creative process, honed over many years of painting urban landscapes. And now I don't live in New Jersey. For the past 21 years, I've been living in New Rochelle, which I'm in the Bronx in 8 minutes. So I now live on the outskirts of Manhattan and the Bronx. So there and Queens and Brooklyn, these areas are much more accessible to me. So my early training there in New Jersey, living in and painting in those industrial parks, has helped me. But I have to admit, when I first got to New Rochelle, New York, where I currently live, I thought, what am I going to do now? Oh my God, I don't know this area. It's all new. And I worried because I knew New Jersey, Northern New Jersey, industrial New Jersey. It was like the back of my hand. But luckily for me, I found out pretty quickly, within a few minutes of my home here, there are all kinds of, there's the Eastchester Barge Canal. There's all this industrial area. And then as you get deeper in, there's lots of infrastructure, bridges, cool buildings. So this is how, and I should get back to your original question. This is how an average day goes for me. The process usually starts for every year in the winter, believe it or not, like in January and February. That's when I do my explorations into the urban areas around where I live. So what I do is I drive till I see something that catches my eye. I park my car. I bring a sketchbook. Cell phones make it really easy to take a few photos so I remember the place. And I take some quick pen and ink rollerball sketches. And I just start to think about a place. And in the winter, when the trees are all bare, I can see things I would miss when in the warmer months when all the trees are in full leaf and you really can't see much. Because I kind of like to go into places that most people try to overlook. I'm interested in the world around us that most of us don't even take a second look at. the infrastructure, the bridges, the abandoned buildings, the graffiti, which is like, you know, writing on the wall. Somebody made that. There's all kinds of interesting stuff around us. And so I do my, like I said, my exploration in the winter months. And then as it starts to get a little warmer in March, then I go back to the sites that had interest me and I see if they're really worthy of me spending, you know, weeks, months. Mm. Sometimes if I find a place that's really great, I can paint there for a couple of years and do a whole series of paintings, as I did with this abandoned golf center that is like 10 minutes from my house. That's always great. And I found that site, it's in the Bronx. I found that site as I was driving down a major highway and I just looked over to the right and I said, what's that colorful thing? I never saw that before. Dead of winter. I pulled off the highway, my car, walked around this giant site and found a hole in the fence. There was a fence. It was an old, I guess it would have been called a family entertainment center. It had miniature golf. It had a putting range. It had a driving range. It had batting cages. So it had all these different things. And there was like a main building where people could get probably ice cream and stuff like that. So it was a place where, you know, people would take their kids or the adults would, you know, practice their swing for the driving range. And it's used. It's over 12 acres or something. Well, once I found that portal, that broken, cut open fence, I'm like, I can fit right in there. So I went in, made some sketches, came back a few weeks later with my paints, climbed in the fence too, and said, all right, I'm going to try a few small paintings. When I go to a new site and I don't really know the lay of the land yet, I always start small. I think the first one was maybe 18 by 24. And I think I did a 12 by 16 too. Because what I didn't say earlier is I work on one painting in the morning and one painting in the afternoon because the light changes so dramatically after about 3 hours. So I went through the fence with my painting gear and my bag and my French easel and set up and I started one in the morning and then I went over to the side and did another view of this really fabulous structure, which is all overgrown with vines and all kinds of stuff. And after, you know, a couple of weeks, I felt like, oh, this place is cool. Nobody's kicking me out. I mean, some cops did come in one time, but they did just be careful. They left me alone. And so I just kept painting there and I spent 2 years painting there.
Wow. See, that's incredible. I'm quite surprised that they let you continue because I feel like over here in the UK, I feel like if I jumped through a hole in the fence to anywhere with, like, say, a camera because I didn't have a photographer, I'd get kicked out straight away. Or there'd be like some trespassing law I'm breaking. But that's really cool, actually.
Well, let me give you a little tip here.
Yeah.
As we all know, it's hard to be an artist, but it's even harder for women. That's just the way the art world has always been. And while it's better than it was, which I'm grateful for, it's not as good as it could be. Yeah. Still, most major shows are by men, not by women artists, in museums and better galleries and everything else. It's changing, but it's like a tortoise. It's going really slow. Yeah. Anyway, but here's the one thing that works for me. Being a woman, because when cops see me or people that own these properties see me, they think, what is she going to do? And I'm petite. I'm 5'2" on a good day, you know, and, you know, people just, and I'm polite and I'm well-spoken and I'm never rude. I just say, hi, I'm just painting. I never leave a mess, which is true. I never leave any garbage or anything. I believe, you know, even if the place is a hot mess, it's not for me to add to it.
Yes.
Yeah. So in this case, because I have had male artist friends of mine be surprised at some of the places I've gotten into and painted. Yeah. And they've said, how did you do that? And I said, well, you know, I just asked. Because usually I try to be on sidewalks and stuff, which are public properties, because nobody can stop you then. But sometimes you just got to go through that fence or you got to get on that property. And even if there is no fence, it might belong to somebody. So I just, you know, I'm polite, I'm kind, and I usually get a yes. Whereas my male artist friends, they've tried the same thing and they've gotten no's sometimes, where I've gotten to yes pretty quickly.
Wow. See, that's what I think is really amazing. Also, the fact that you're willing to put yourself out there and ask. I think also a lot of the time people don't want to ask. They feel like, oh, it's public property, I have a right to be here. When actually, if you ask and you have an idea and you'd be honest with what you're doing as well, I don't see why there should be any reason that people are going to stop you unless owned by somebody. I think it's kind of interesting. Also, because it's a painting as well and you're going there time after time, you know, you can bring the place to the public, like to the forefront of the public. So like, you're kind of also highlighting the place also. It's kind of really interesting how you have that ability to be able to kind of, I guess, transpose reality through your work, because that's also what I'm interested in. Like, do you want your work to be like documentary? Are you documenting these places that you're painting?
Absolutely. I am documenting a changing city. It is the nature of the human race. We build, we destroy, and we rebuild. So one of my interests, and I have several, but one of my main interests is capturing some of these places that are basically contemporary ruins, you know, like the pyramids in Egypt or something. And in a changing city, things are always being demolished and being replaced. And unfortunately, a lot of times the stuff that replaces the older stuff isn't as interesting, doesn't have much of a story. It's a condo building or it's a storage unit. I mean, like, you know, we don't necessarily need more of those. But these other places, like the abandoned golf center and the place that I'm currently working on, this power plant that is no longer in use in Yonkers, New York, these places are historically fascinating. The architecture is interesting. There's just the hints at a past life are fascinating. And then the other thing for me, that the main reason I paint on location is not because I have anything against photos. As I said, if I think I need a person or something else in a painting, I'll take a photo and throw it in. But what I really want to do is get to know a place intimately. And that happens through meeting people who tell me, who work and live in these areas, who tell me stories about these places. And those conversations, while they may not be evident in the painting, for me, they inform what I do, and I think they make the paintings a little richer because I know so much and I can, you know, incorporate certain things in my paintings because I didn't just take a few photos and went home. I really get to know a place. And I just love, I mean, I am a documentarian in that sense, but I'm also a bit of a historian too. Yeah. When I was in high school, I didn't know that I was going to be an artist. I thought maybe I was going to be a writer or maybe an English major or maybe a history teacher because I liked reading and I liked history a lot. And in some way, I've combined those interests into my painting.
Yeah. I feel like the main thread to all of those different factors is the idea of storytelling, which is what you do through your work.
I am a visual storyteller. That's what I like to consider myself.
Yeah, because that makes perfect sense. And that's actually a really, really great kind of complete way to talk about yourself, because what you're doing is you are talking about a history within a piece of work, because it's not just the image itself that is what you're talking about. You're talking about everything that's gone into it in terms of all the years of change, also what it's going to become also. It's kind of fascinating because you're capturing almost like this snapshot of a place or of a particular thing and saying, like, this is what it looks like now. What would it look like? What has it looked like before? And what would it look like in the future? And I think that's kind of really interesting because it is, a document of the city, or it's just like it's almost like a collection. I guess I just said earlier, it's almost like a collection of relics. And like in the future, you can look back on this and be like, this is how it used to look. What's it look like now? Maybe it's like a mall or something, or maybe it's like a cinema.
Condos and storage units, let me tell you.
But I think,
the golf center, it's still standing, although they've made it almost impossible to get in. It's a long story. I won't go into all the details because I was there for 2 years, so I have so many stories. But they eventually, there were some homeless people living there. They kicked them out and they made it the place like a fortress. It's really hard to get in now. And they've already demolished the back area of this place where there were batting cages and deteriorating batting cage nets. Oh my God, they were so ethereal and so gorgeous. Who would have thought that deteriorating batting cage nets could be so beautiful? Well, let me tell you, they are. But now that area is gone, and it's a parking lot for the bus depot, the MTA next door. So, you know, they were supposed to, they did try cleaning the lot up at one point, and I got to know the landscapers who were cutting down trees and stuff. And they let me alone. They knew I was just painting in the back by the batting cage nets. And but then all of a sudden it just stopped. You know, they cleaned out the area. In a couple of years, the place was all overgrown again. And then the mall that, and it was supposed to be senior housing and a mall that was going to go there, never happened. And now, like I said, part of the area where I was painting in the way back area is now part of the MTA parking for their buses. So you never know what's going to happen. Mm. And another interesting thing is that way too often, more often than I wish, I'll go, like I'll take a few snapshots, I'll do a few sketches, and I'll think I'll get back to that site. And then I'll get back there and it's just totally changed, you know? And it's like, I don't want to paint this now. The ones that got away.
Yeah. Of course, and that's the interesting thing about your work is about discovery. It's about discovery, not just for the viewer, but for you as the artist creating the work. It's like, you know, it's you asking yourself, why is this important to me? Or what is it about this particular occasion that I want to highlight and kind of showcase, I guess, more than anything else? Because the interesting thing about any piece of art is that the artists have chosen that particular spot or that particular person or that particular form even to capture and share with the world. And it's kind of interesting because it's like, we get a really interesting look into your mind through your work.
That's true. And what appeals to me? And like I said, almost every January and February, I'm not really sure what I'm going to paint that year. I have a few things
that
I didn't get to the years before. So I'll go back and research those areas again. But then something else may pop up. Like this power plant in Yonkers. Oh my God, the it's historically important. The architecture is amazing. It's like a cathedral, an industrial cathedral. And I tried to get into that site 10 years ago and couldn't find a portal, couldn't find a break in the fence or anything like that. So I was like, oh well, that's not gonna happen. And then I met somebody and they knew the portal. They knew exactly how to get in and they took me there. And once I got in, I'm like, oh my God, this place is fascinating on so many levels. And what's interesting about fascinating urban sites that have interesting architecture and maybe overgrown with some weeds or stuff or really cool graffiti is that they become a creative mecca, not just for me, but for the community. Like this power plant, when I've been in there painting, because I have done several paintings there in the fall, I saw graffiti artists, of course, that's they've got to practice and they got to get their tags out there. But I also saw people filming movies, you know, short videos, music videos, fashion shoots. And then most recently there in the fall, were these people who call themselves highliners. The ceilings are extremely high in this one part of the building. It's probably, I don't know, 30, 40 feet high. It's like several, maybe I'm exaggerating, but it's really high. It's several floors and it's just wide open all the way to the ceiling. And these people strung ropes across and then they harness themselves so that they wouldn't fall and go splat because there's no net. And then they do tightrope walking and flips and other stuff. And I'm like, I'm down there painting and I'm looking up at these people doing this amazing thing. You know, you don't get that from a photograph, my friend.
And also, that's really interesting because all of that kind of crazy environment, like you all let each other get on with it. Nobody is stopping you from doing this and that, or you're not telling somebody, oh, no, you can't do that. And that will inform the work itself, you know, the conversations you have, the time you spend there, the way the environment you're in, that all impacts the work in some way.
It does. And it makes, you know, it makes it fascinating. I'm never bored. You know, I'm never sitting in my studio going, oh, what should I do today? You know, I go out in the world around me and there's always something fascinating going on.
Yeah.
And this is why I just love painting on site. For me, there is absolutely nothing better. And I'm going to anticipate a question you might ask because I get this often. Are my paintings exactly like what I see in front of me? No, they are a lot like what I see in front of me, but don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. So if I want to move something from a different part of the lot, I can do that. If I want to add something, I will do that. So there are ways that people would never know because I get you to believe my reality, but things are not gridded. They're not projected. I'm not a photorealist. I am an artist in the world around me, trying to capture what I see, trying to tell a story of a particular place and time. And that's what I do. And being on site allows me to do that in a better way. And also, for me, it's just fascinating. The world is just a fascinating place if you go down and really get into the nitty-gritty.
So that is actually really interesting because a lot of the time artists will just spend time in their studio and they will kind of isolate themselves from the rest of the world and kind of be in their own kind of creative bubble. Whereas when you're going out in the world, so therefore, like, you know, you'll talk to people on site and you need like people asking what you're doing. And I guess the same, it's kind of almost like painting murals outside. It's like people will stop and ask you, or the city itself becomes a part of the work, or the environment becomes part of the work. It's not just you sitting in your studio creating a beautiful image that looks lifelike. It's you actually remembering where you were and actually creating from, you know, being in the site, being on site. I think that's really fascinating, actually. The idea, particularly the whole idea of like reality, because that's definitely one thing I wanted to touch upon in your work, because to me, your work is lifelike, but it's not photoreal. And the fact that you said that, you know, you can change things, like that's kind of interesting because it also, it kind of almost highlights like the illusion of reality of art, like what you think you're looking at might not actually be what was actually there. However, at the same time, it also was because the place you're painting is a real place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like as you remember it, not as it actually is. Very much like a film. Like films are based on stories that were created, not an actual thing that happened. It's almost like the idea of like recall and the idea of like what's actually really true when you look at a painting. And I think that's actually really fascinating to me, particularly of like landscapes.
And, you know, like I said, I don't know what's going to change. And sometimes I even incorporate those changes. I'll give you an example. I was working on this painting in the North Bronx, once again, very close to my home. And it was this lot, and there was some graffiti on these old, there was an old truck body on either side. And then you could see this auto repair shop, and they had really good signage. Just to talk about, I'm going to change the subject for just a second. I've always enjoyed, even in my earlier industrial paintings, having some lettering and signage, industrial commercial signage. So this place had that, but also had the graffiti, which is just another form of signage as far as I'm concerned. So this site had both of those things going on and these overgrown weeds, and it was just a really cool place. And then one day I show up at my site. I worked on that painting for over 2 months, and there's a boat. There's a boat. I mean, we're a big boat. And there was a cement barrier that they had to lift up with a crane to get that boat into this lot and then put the cement barrier back.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, the boat. What do I do? Do I ignore the boat? I mean, I had enough of what was behind it done. I could have faked it. Or do I include the boat? But the boat's too pristine. It doesn't really go. What am I going to do? And I just kept painting. I wasn't really sure, but I just kept painting because it takes me, you know, a good amount of time to finish a painting. And one day, this guy, say it, I still remember his tag and still remember meeting him. He comes around the barrier and he's got a can of spray paint in his hand. And I say, are you going to christen the boat? And he says, I am. And I said, yay. So he put his tag really large twice on the side of this pristine white boat. And then he left. And I'm like, oh, well, that changes everything. Now it really fits. And matter of fact, now it's even fascinating because what the hell is this boat doing here? So I included it. Same thing happened on the left. That was on the right side of the painting. Same similar thing happened on the left side of the painting. Somebody just dumped these mattresses there. And I'm like, mattresses. What? But I kept looking at them. And as the weeds started growing up around the mattresses, I'm like, I don't know. I think I like those. So I added those too. And then another guy came in and he said, do you mind if I tag this area that you're working on? I said, no, go ahead. Have at it. And he did a really nice job. His name was Dara. And so I included him. Dara and Smog, his friend, they were both there. So I included that graffiti. They made it actually better. So in a way, change can be my friend. It is not necessarily my enemy. Just keep an open mind.
So also, because of the fact that you go back after so long as well, because you're there for such a period of time, you actually see the change of the environment. Like, that's interesting as well. Because as you said, like, what had you just taken a photograph and left, you never have understood, oh, actually, maybe with this addition would be better, or maybe taking this away would be better, or maybe like, oh, actually, it is more interesting this way. Like, that's actually fascinating, this idea of spending a time in a place that to inform the work, rather than just creating the work and you know, throwing it out there, or creating the work and storing it away. Like, your work evolves with you as much as your view of the world evolves too. That's interesting.
And my view of the world does evolve with painting on site. I've met so many people, and I've learned a lot about people who are homeless. I've learned a lot about, you know, animals that people dump or don't get fixed or whatever. I've done trap, neuter, and release of feral cats. I've rescued a few dogs, including the dog I own now, Tula, who I adopted from a homeless person. And I am always learning. And maybe that's the other part of painting on location, is that I learn from the world around me in a way I wouldn't if I was just in my own head, in my studio, by myself. So the give and take between me and the world around me has helped me understand a lot of things that I might not have understood otherwise.
And also, it's nice because you have so much to talk about in terms of the work itself. Like, the locations themselves, rather than just like, oh, it's a nice location, I liked it. Like, there's a meaning and reason that you chose this location, and also how your opinion of it's developed over time, or your opinion of the paintings developed over time. Because, you know, it's like every single piece of your work has a story behind it. And actually, would you ever consider like creating some kind of like photo book where you have like your paintings and some of the stories behind it, or maybe some of the pieces, people who live there, or memories of the area, something like that potentially?
Well, I thought about it, and I have written about different series, but I'm not, as I said, I started painting, you know, in community college. I didn't really hone my writing skills. I went to art school and community college. I have no degree. I just have an art certificate, which for what I do is fine. I mean, I can write because I was an avid reader most of my life. Especially when I was younger, oh my God, reading was my escape besides painting and making art. And so I can get my thoughts out there, but I'm not a polished writer. So making a book just hasn't really been at the forefront of my thoughts, although I have thought about it. And who knows, maybe at some point somebody will help me do that. I think I need a ghostwriter.
I think there are definitely several companies that would be interested. I feel like just to discover you in the right time and place, I think it would be absolutely really, really interesting. I definitely think it could be something that would be very kind of worthwhile, a worthwhile pursuit, I think. Yeah.
Well, we'll see. Someone who is an editor has reached out to me and asked me, you know, do I want to have a book of my art? And of course, I would love that. And we'll see. She said she'd be happy to work with me. But at the same time, she reached out to me, the gentleman, Jeremy Huff, who is making the documentary film about me. He reached out to me, and I decided to go with the film first because that's just like breathing to me. I'm out there painting anyway. You know, a book would take a different focus, and, you know, I like the other idea just because it was easier for me.
Yeah, no, of course, absolutely. It's just going to give you a bit more creative freedom, and also the ability to be able to just kind of know, do what you know, as opposed to having to spend time focusing your energy elsewhere other than the work you want to create.
Right. And I love to paint. Right. That's my thing.
So I wanted to ask you a bit about your series, Sign of the Times, because that's actually really fascinating to me. Because there's an idea of these like really strange billboards. And could you just talk a bit about that series and kind of like how it came about?
Sure. It started a number of years ago. I haven't mentioned this yet, but in the winter, I sit in my car and paint. You know, it's too cold. Not only do I do exploration, I also do what I call car paintings.
Oh, wow.
So a number of years ago, right before the Great Recession, so around 2007, maybe even was at the start of the Great Recession, 2008. I think that is when the series started, but I didn't know it was going to start. I did a little gouache and watercolor in my car, and I called it Sign of the Times. And it was three blank billboards. And so it probably was right around the beginning of the Great Recession. And I painted that, and I called it that. I don't know why. I just did. There were three of them. And then I kind of put it aside. It was a car painting. I probably painted several other car paintings, gouaches that season. And then I went out and started painting whatever it was I was going to paint. And then a few years later, I did a large painting of a billboard in my main season. And it too was blank. It was just a big yellow with buildings and an old water tower. And it just appealed to me. And I think it had a little bit of graffiti, but not much. Anyway, I liked that painting. And then I liked the other blank ones. And then I started noticing, because I'm out in the world exploring all the time, that there were a lot more, you know, blank billboards all of a sudden in 2009 and 2010. And they didn't really come back for a while. So eventually what I started doing was some small, these were done in my car also, some small billboard paintings. I have a Pouchard box. What I do in oil in the car that I put on my lap and then I do the painting there. It has a palette and everything. It's very convenient for travel painting and for sitting in your car painting. So I did a couple of these little small sign of the times. I decided to I did three and I thought those look good together. And then a curator came into my studio. I had them off in the corner. They really weren't anything at this point. They were just a little experiment. And this curator said, "What are those over in that corner?" I said, "Oh, just a little thing I've been playing around with." She said, "We like these. We like these a lot. Can we have these for the show?" I said, "Sure." And then I thought, maybe I should do more. So I had three. So I did six more and exhibited them in a grid. Oh. And all of a sudden, a series was born. It all kind of coalesced. It all kind of gelled. And then after that, those nine that I showed, I started paying so much attention to billboards because while a lot were still blank, there were other ones that were popping up especially during the pandemic. There were ones with religious sayings. They're all over the Bronx. There were ones with injury lawyers. Some of them are downright hilarious. So this series has become ongoing. Even though I sold a lot of those early ones, most of them are gone. I have continued to create this series because some of the billboards I see, and I drive to New Jersey still one day a week to teach. Oh my God, New Jersey has some of the most hilarious billboards you ever saw. Ones for penis enlargement, non-surgical. Well, I got to tell you, one of the funniest billboard. It says size matters. Guy's holding a ruler out. It looks like it's 12 inches, non-surgical enhancement, and other fantasies we'd like to sell you. And then there are other ones I've seen where these ambulance chaser lawyers, we used to call them ambulance chasers when I was a kid, would have these hilarious billboards too. Some of those say size matter, biggest injury law firm. You know, it's just, they all play off of each other. And then I guess it was about 2 years ago, I saw my first environmental billboard right here in New Rochelle, right up the street from me. And it was, you know, love it or lose it about the, you know, the oceans and keeping the oceans clean. So I'm discovering that these billboards can both be humorous but also a definite sign of the times, the things that people are thinking about and trying to get you to think about, whether they're trying to sell you something or just trying to get you to think and make the world a better place.
See, that's interesting, because I feel like advertising, especially in today's society, is there's so much advertisement everywhere all the time. And it kind of also almost begs the question, like, how much do we pay attention to it? And the idea that you are looking at billboards, which are kind of like the kind of very old school methods of advertising nowadays, that still have stood the test of time as well, especially like motorways and stuff like that. Like, that's fascinating to me, because not only does it show that actually a lot of the old school methods still work and still work well, but also, like, you are right, these signs do change with the times. What was relevant 30 years ago is not necessarily relevant today. And the fact that it also looks at the idea of, like, space and ownership, and, like, who has access to these spaces? Who chooses what is able to become, like, the advertisement on a billboard, and who has approved this as an important message? Like, because I also feel like when I see, like, a blank billboard or just, like, a blank advertising space, like, that's so strange to me, because we're so used to seeing text everywhere and images everywhere and being bombarded. And I think it actually, the interesting thing about this series specifically as well, it also speaks to kind of like the 21st century, and like kind of, it's almost like anti-digital age, because going back to the old school billboards, I quite like that. I was very kind of like taken with that.
And now we have these electronic billboards.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so in addition to the series where they're 10 inches by 10 inches and 10 inches by 8 inches that I show in a grid, I also do some larger paintings with billboards in them, because they are part of the urban environment. And I do find the messages fascinating. Like the back to the abandoned Bronx golf center that I spent a couple of years painting at. There was an electronic billboard right behind these old buildings from the golf center. And the image would change all the time. And I wasn't sure which image I was going to ultimately put on the billboard, because it'd only be up there for 60 seconds. And I knew whatever image I was going to choose, I would have to take a photo with my cell phone and, you know, do that in the studio, because it wasn't going to stay there long enough. And one day, this little creature showed up on the billboard, the head of this little creature. And it was an animal of some sort. It was more cartoony, though. And I thought, that's it. I like that big animal head. So I took a photo of it. And then I realized it was for a movie called The Secret Life of Pets. And then it became even better, because while I was painting there, there was a feral cat colony. And I met Bill, who used to come in to feed the cats and leave food every week. He'd come in every Wednesday. I'd see him every Wednesday. I'd be painting, you know, as long as the weather wasn't pouring rain. He'd come in to refill the feeder and put some wet food and fresh water down. And I'd be there painting. And we're still friends to this day, me and Bill. Okay. And the Secret Life of Pets, because there was a Secret Life of Pets at this site, which is just my insider joke, but it's a fact. And like I said, I wound up adopting my dog from somebody at the abandoned golf center.
Wow. So that's cool as well, because you don't think about, like, even in a sense, like the communities that still are attracted or still live or still thrive within these places. Because, you know, from afar, it's like, oh, there's just like an abandoned golf center. But actually, when you're there, you realize it's still shelter for somebody. It's still a home for somebody. It still has its own uses, just because it's not used for its original intention.
Oh, and these places are sanctuaries for urban wildlife too.
Yeah.
Raccoons, opossums, you know, there's a whole geese. I saw baby geese there. Wow. There's a whole other world. And once again, I am a big animal lover. I have done rescue work, and I find that fascinating. So the more you dig into these places, the more you learn. And you don't get that from a photograph. You have to be willing to be out in the world with all its messiness. I mean, I've been asked, well, what do you do about the rain, the sun, the wind, the bugs? I've got ways to work around most of these things. Learned over time, you know, I got better at learning things. But it's just really good for me to be out in the world and to not just sit in my studio and navel gaze, let's say.
Yeah, of course. Oh, that's amazing. So I wanted to briefly ask you about the murals that you painted for the Jersey Transit and the New Jersey State Council. Could you talk a bit about this kind of commission that you did, the murals, and kind of like what the experience was that you got from it?
Sure. Well, the murals. What can I say? I'm not a muralist. And these are, but I am a painter. And I was just approached by the New Jersey State Council on the Arts. I was living in New Jersey when I was approached by the New Jersey State Council of the Arts. And I knew the guy who was running that, Tom Moran. And I forget if I got a phone call or an email, who knows back then. And he asked, would you be interested in applying for this? Here are the, you know, the guidelines, what we want, what we're looking for. There are two mezzanines. There's one on in the West Wing and there's one in the, or I think it's North and South. I got the North mezzanine. There are two mezzanines. I got the North one. Somebody else wound up with the South one. So I read it over and I thought, you know, it's not necessarily that I want to do this, but it's a really big, high profile, you know, commission. I should take a look at this. So I did research. And I tend to like doing that anyway. And the Secaucus Transfer Station, now renamed the Frank Lautenberg Station, is a station that tied together all of the train lines in the north half of New Jersey, the north half of the state. So I decided to pick four areas from the north part of the state, four corners, and to paint bridges, which I love anyway. I have always loved a good bridge, and to include train bridges in particular, since this was going to be in a train station. So I wrote up the proposal, made some sketches, presented it to the committee, and shocker, I won. Me and my friend Tim Daly won the other mezzanine, the South mezzanine, which was much larger, and I totally did not want. I wanted the smaller room because I figured I could do that. Yes. And two of the murals are quite large. They're 5.5 feet high by almost 30 feet long. And I had to rent a studio because I was, you know, my studio is my car and, you know, a little, at that point, I had turned my dining room in this house I rented into my indoor studio. So I had no place to do anything this large. So I rented a studio, a space. I hired an assistant because I couldn't even move those canvases without an assistant. Plus, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life working on these. I wanted to try and get them done as quickly as possible so I could go back out to painting on location, my true love. And I did it. Luckily, the person I hired to help me, her name is Kit Saylor, had done murals before. So she was a good person to work with. And Tim Daly was a good person to work with because we worked together when we needed to get certain things out of New Jersey Transit. There's safety in numbers. I'll leave that there. But I guess that's all I have to say. I'm happy I did it, but I wouldn't want to do it again. It takes away from my real love, which is painting urban landscapes on location and being out in the world around me.
Yeah, because I think I'm kind of both not surprised, but also surprised. I kind of feel like working on location could almost be like creating a mural. But I guess with a mural, there's like a deadline. There's kind of almost like boxes you have to tick, as opposed to being like you being out in the environment, creating your own work. It's down to you to kind of tick your own boxes and know what you want to do. But because it's
freedom,
like,
it's called freedom.
Yeah. Creative freedom. Yeah, actually, absolutely.
I get to paint whatever I want, and I'm still shocked that people like it and buy it. Yeah. It has never ceased to amaze me that I paint what interests me and other people, you know, it resonates with them. The murals, yes. The committee also said, fine about the train bridges, but we think it'd be more interesting if you had a contemporary train, because I was putting vintage trains on these train lines and I did the research. And then they said, well, one train should have a contemporary, one bridge mural should have a contemporary train in it. So I did that.
Yeah.
And one of my students, her son posed for one of the other. There are a few people, not a lot, just a couple in these murals. And that kid wound up growing up to be a train conductor. The kid is posed.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
That's cool. But also, yeah, it's kind of, you're right, it's like the creative freedom, the idea of like, you're kind of almost told what to do. It's not, you don't have the creative expression that you want as an artist, but the whole point of being an artist is that you can do what you want, you know.
Right.
It's kind of the whole fun of it, which is really cool, you know. It's what you want.
I called myself a brush for hire with that, with those murals. That's what I was. I had the skill set, if not, you know, a burning desire to do murals.
Yeah.
And those murals are very detailed, and most people don't realize that. They're huge. But I still did all the details with a number two brush, which is a fairly small paintbrush.
Wow. Yeah. That's cool. And also, it's a lesson learned. You know what you don't want to do. So you know where you want to spend your time and energy moving forward, which is good. It's an experience.
And I'm always willing to try something new. Mm. Always.
So what's creating art taught you about yourself?
That one is not something I really can answer. I think it's more that in the way you might want me to answer.
Yeah.
When you ask me that question, I think art saved me. It's that simple. Yeah. It gave me a purpose. It gave me joy. It gave me life. That's it. It hasn't necessarily taught me something, but it's made me into a better person.
Yeah. Which one could argue is a lot better because it's given you the life you have now, really.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm very, very fortunate to have the life I have now. Wasn't always easy. There were times when I didn't know how I was going to pay the rent. There were times when I didn't, I just thought, this is all too hard. Why am I doing this to myself? I should have become a lawyer, which is kind of funny. Would have made more money. But then I get over that. You know, things get better. I sell a painting. I've won a few grants here and there. I get contacted by a museum that wants to give me a solo show. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, okay. I can keep doing this. I love this.
Like, do you do it for the money, though?
No. I have to make enough to support myself so I can keep painting.
Yes.
But I have never made art for the money, except for the mural. And even then, the money wasn't very good for those murals. I was not paid very well, but I knew it would be high profile and would get my name out there. And that's why I did it. I did not do it for the money. As I told my husband when we first got together, I said, if I was motivated by money, I would have chose any other field than being an artist.
Yeah, because I feel like that's one of the biggest things that artists struggle with, particularly newer artists struggle with when I speak to them. It's the idea of like, oh, how do I make money? Not just to buy more supplies, but to kind of live. Because you kind of almost forget, like, it's not just you buying money to create more work. It's also the fact, you know, you have to eat. You have to have an everyday to day life. You're not just an artist. You're also a human being. You have to have things, health have to pay your rent. Yeah, you have to, Oh, yeah, especially over in America, absolutely. Yes, very different over here. But you're right, of course. And it's like, you have to remember, you have to, and you know, if you want to go on holiday or, you know, it's just travel costs and like everything adds up. And you have to realize there is a budget or there is money that you have to make to kind of live a certain lifestyle. You have to kind of figure out your lifestyle first and figure out how your art plays into that. And what can you afford to do? What can you not afford to do? What are you willing to sacrifice? I think a lot of people forget that. They just look at artists on Instagram making thousands of pounds and being like, oh, I want to do that, when it's not that easy.
Oh my God. Let me just say that it is incredibly hard to make a living as an artist. And earlier in my career, I had to have waitress jobs. I had to have all kinds of jobs that I could not stand, a lot of them, just so I could make sure I could put a roof over my head. But at the same time, and I think this is true for just about every artist who sticks with it, it's your soul, it's your vocation. You're not doing it because you think you're going to make money. You're just making sacrifices so that you can get by to do the thing you love. And one of the things I've always said to my students and to other people when they ask about making a living, I say, live frugally and learn how to save and budget so that you can survive to paint another day. Yeah. That means that when you get a windfall, you sell some work, don't just blow it because you haven't had money in a while. pay off your credit card if you have that, pay some bills, put some money away for a rainy day. Yes. I've always put money away. I didn't own a new car until I was much, much older. I never bought a new car when I was younger. I never bought fancy clothes. I mean, I had roommates my entire adult life until I met my husband, best roommate I ever have. But, you know, I had to make sacrifices. But to me, it was necessity. I wanted to paint. And I'm happy I made those sacrifices because they worked for me.
So what would be your biggest piece of advice to any artist out there who wants to, or anybody who wants to become an artist who is an artist?
Well, don't get yourself in debt. That can be deadly. Don't be in love with things. When I mean things, I mean designer clothes or fancy shoes or pocket, you know. Learn to live frugally, learn to save, learn to promote yourself so that you have a chance of selling artwork. Think of yourself as a small business. Figure out what you need to get your stuff out there so that you have sales. Open studios are a great way to get your friends and family in to see your work. People don't realize some of their best collectors are their friends and family. Don't be afraid to tell them, hey, I've got an open studio. Hey, I've got a show. Come on in, see what I'm doing. Yeah. I'm always willing to let people into my studio. Matter of fact, Saturday morning, I have an open studio event. Just a studio. I shouldn't say an open studio. I'm not having an open studio. On Saturday, I'm having somebody who's been interested in my work come in to possibly buy something. A new collector. Fingers crossed.
So can anybody be an artist?
Of course they can be, but can everybody be a good artist or an accomplished artist or a successful artist? Anybody can be an artist, and art comes in many forms. You can be an artist at whatever you do, whether it's writing or music or interior design. However, if you're not willing to make a lot of sacrifices and you weren't born rich, then you really have to work hard at this and really figure stuff out so that you can survive as an artist. And the longer you paint and the more you paint, the better you get. I've been teaching art for 33 years, and I see the people who really improve. I teach adults. I see the people who really improve are the people who put the most time in. It's that simple. So if you have a full-time job, how much painting are you getting done? So you got to figure out what you can do to be able to paint as much as you can and work a side job as little as you absolutely have to.
Or you could just not sleep. That also works too.
Nah, really burnout. See, I don't have burnout artistically, but not sleeping, not so good. I don't advise it.
Yeah, actually, to be fair, judging where my life's going currently, I don't advise it too. So what would your younger self think about your work?
That's a funny question. I think my younger self would be surprised that I wound up doing as well as I did and that I stuck with it and that I became a much better painter than I started out after art school.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing to kind of think about. Your younger self would feel like that way, because it's nice to reflect upon, like, how far you've actually come and actually what a journey it's been to get to where you are now.
It's been a journey with ups and downs, but in the end, it's made me who I am. And I'm grateful for my life. As I said earlier, I'm fortunate that I wound up being of sound mind and body, and I'm very healthy, and I can do this thing that I love. And another thing, which I don't think I touched on earlier, is because I grew up in such strange and difficult circumstances, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm willing to climb through that fence. I'm not worried about anybody coming after me. I'm tough, you know, and that has helped me. I'm happy and I'm tough.
That's amazing. But the last question, double barrel question, is what are you currently working on and where can people find more about you and your work?
I'm currently working on, you had asked this earlier, or you had written in the questions, I painted a lot of different sizes. I painted my car small paintings. For all my major paintings, I do studies. So I finish those working from the large painting in my studio in the winter. And then a couple of years ago, I was showing at this gallery in Basin Basin Gallery and Studios in Red Hook, Brooklyn. And the curator, owner of the gallery, handed me a little 2-inch by 3-inch canvas and said, could you paint something this small so me and Jamie can afford you? She meant it as a joke. And instead of laughing, I said, give me that. I'll try. And then she goes, well, I have five of them. I said, give them all to me. I painted them all. And then I painted more. And then they sold them all. So now another thing that I have been doing in the winter months is, and it is, you know, early February, is doing these miniatures. I also, just 2 years ago, started experimenting on painting oils on aluminum panels and letting some of the aluminum come through so there's a little extra light and stuff happening. So I've been experimenting with that. I've been doing some miniatures, and those I do in the studio from photos of places that got away. Remember I said I like to take photos to remind me of places I can get back to? Well, I've saved some of those photos just because even though the places are gone, I just really like the photo. Yeah. And these were the basis for the miniatures when Liz jokingly said, can you paint something this small? And let me tell you, painting something 2 inches by 3 inches is much harder than painting something 3 feet by 6 feet. I'm just telling you. It's much harder. To me, painting larger is actually easier. And then the other thing I'm going to do as soon as the weather gets better in March is I will be back out at the power plant painting in Yonkers, New York. Now, there's a caveat to that. I did meet the developer and her lead construction guy when I was there in the fall. They kicked me out, but I figured out how to get back in when they weren't around. So I finished my paintings anyway. And so they were supposedly going to start the renovation in December, but they didn't. I was painting there through right before Christmas. I was still painting there. And so I went back recently to check out the site for a different reason, which is just a different topic. And the place is still not locked up. It's wide open. Wow. And I'm thinking, if this is like this in March, I'm coming right back. And we'll see what happens. So that's my goal. But if that doesn't happen, I'll find something else. There's always something.
Yeah, absolutely. So where can people find more about your work online?
The best way is to follow me on Instagram. It's just my name, Valerie Larko. Valerie without an E at the end, V-A-L-E-R-I. L-A-R-K-O. And that's the best way because I post my most recent stuff that I'm working on Instagram. And I post it, you know, like work in progress shots and stuff like that. And I make funny videos sometimes, which is in a way almost like the book idea you said earlier. I can talk about these sites, you know, briefly, but it's kind of like getting the stories behind the paintings out there. And then the other way is I have a website, once again, ValerieLarko.com. And I do post on Facebook too, and a teeny bit on TikTok, but not so much. I'd say Instagram and Facebook if you want to follow me on social media. And then my website if you just want an exhaustive take on what I do. Because my website is almost like an archive too. There's older work in there too.
Yes. Valerie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. This was great.
That concludes my conversation with Valerie Larko. Thank you very much for listening. If you have any questions or comments about it, please send me an email at theflyingfreebowl@gmail.com. We'll get in touch via social media sites such as Twitter and Instagram. The Flying Free Bowl podcast can be found on a variety of sites, such as Spotify, YouTube, and Apple Music. If you like the show, please consider rating, reviewing, sharing, or subscribing on any of those platforms to help spread the word. Also, don't forget to check out theflyingfreebowl.co.uk for daily art inspiration, and if you're a creative, please get in touch for a chance to be featured or interviewed. We now also have a Patreon page if you're interested in supporting the platform further. Tiers up for £1, and more information for rewards can be found over on patreon.com/theflyingfreebowl. Additionally, we also have a PayPal for one-time donations if monthly donations are not your thing. I'll include a link to our PayPal in the show notes. Once again, thank you very much for listening to this episode today. Until next time, folks, please stay safe.